This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents Islam and Modernity, Transformation of an Intellectual Tradition. Written by Fazlur Rahman. Narrated by Peter Ganim.
Prefatory note. I began writing this book in 1977 and completed it in 1978, although I have noted certain subsequent developments at the revision stage. Here I want to record that two Pakistani intellectuals, Abul Ala Maududi and Ishtiaq Hussain Qureshi, passed away in September 1979 and in January 1981. Their departure is a loss to Islam, despite my severe and, I believe, perfectly justified criticism of them. Introduction. The following pages are the result of a research project undertaken at the University of Chicago and funded by the Ford Foundation in Islamic Education. This project, which was originally conceived as part of a much larger project entitled Islam and Social Change, directly involved a dozen young scholars besides its co-directors, myself and Professor Leonard Binder. While the younger scholars have undertaken to write monographs on the various Muslim countries they have studied in this project, I have decided to write a general work on the medieval Islamic educational system, with its major features and deficiencies, and on the modernization efforts undertaken during the past century or so. In the last chapter, I have tried to delineate certain general lines along which I believe these efforts should proceed in order to be really fruitful. As the reader will see, by Islamic education, I do not mean physical or quasi-physical paraphernalia and instruments of instruction, such as the books taught or the external educational structure, but what I call Islamic intellectualism. For, to me, this is the essence of higher Islamic education. It is the growth of a genuine, original, and adequate Islamic thought that must provide the real criterion for judging the success or failure of an Islamic educational system. The reader will also be struck by my preoccupation with the correct method of interpreting the Quran, and may well wonder, at first sight, why this question should stand at the center of Islamic intellectualism. The answer is that the Quran, for Muslims, is the divine word literally revealed to the Prophet Muhammad between 710 and 732 CE, in a sense in which probably no other religious document is held to be so. Further, the Quran declares itself to be the most comprehensive guidance for man, both assuming and subsuming earlier revelations. Surah 12, Ayah 111, Surah 10, Ayah 37, Surah 6, Ayah 114. Furthermore, the Quranic revelation and the prophetic career of Muhammad lasted for just over 22 years, during which period all kinds of decisions on policy in peace and in war, on legal and moral issues in private and public life, were made in the face of actual situations. Thus, the Quran had, from the time of its revelation, a practical and political application. It was not a mere devotional or personal pietistic text. Muhammad's prophetic career was likewise geared toward the moral improvement of man in a concrete and communal sense, rather than toward the private and metaphysical. This naturally encouraged the Muslim jurists and intellectuals to look upon the Quran and the model of the Prophet as a unique repository of answers to all sorts of questions. That this approach succeeded in practice further strengthened the original belief of the Muslims in the efficacy of the revelation in providing true answers to virtually all situations. But the basic questions of method and hermeneutics were not squarely addressed by Muslims. The medieval systems of Islamic law worked fairly successfully, partly because of the realism shown by the very early generations, who took the raw materials for this law from the customs and institutions of the conquered lands, modified them, where necessary, in the light of the Quranic teaching, and integrated them with that teaching. Where interpreters attempted to deduce law from the Quran in abstracto, for example, in the area of the penal law called hudud, results were not very satisfactory. This is because the instrument for deriving law and other social institutions, called qiyas, or analogical reasoning, was not perfected to the requisite degree. The imperfection and imprecision of these tools was due, in turn, to the lack of an adequate method for understanding the Quran itself, as I shall detail below. There was a general failure to understand the underlying unity of the Quran, coupled with a practical insistence upon fixing on the words of various verses in isolation. The result of this atomistic approach was that laws were often derived from verses that were not at all legal in intent. For the failure to understand the Quran as a deeper unity yielding a definite Weltanschauung, the greatest penalty was paid in the realm of theological thought. Whereas in the field of law, in the relative absence of such an internally discovered unity, the incorporation of foreign materials introduced a sufficient degree of practicality, the same process of adopting foreign ideas in the field of theology, again in the absence of such a unitary vision of the Quranic Weltanschauung, proved disastrous, at least in the case of Asharism, the dominant Sunni theology throughout medieval Islam. When this Sunni theological system collided in the 12th century CE with the out-and-out rational philosophical metaphysics of the Muslim philosophers, who had erected their thought system on the basis of Greek philosophy, but had nevertheless made serious efforts to accommodate Islamic orthodoxy, the former well-nigh crushed the latter by its sheer weight. Subsequently, philosophy took refuge and developed in a Shi'i intellectual spiritual milieu, or was transformed into intellectual Sufism. The philosophers, and often the Sufis, did understand the Quran as a unity, but this unity was imposed upon the Quran and Islam in general from without, rather than derived from a study of the Quran itself. Certain thought systems and thought orientations were adopted from outside sources, not necessarily wholly antagonistic to the Quran, but certainly alien to and not infrequently incompatible with it. Adapted somewhat to the Islamic mental milieu and expressed mostly in Islamic terminology, but this thin veneer could not hide the fact that their basic structure of ideas was not drawn from within the Quran itself. It is this more or less artificial Islamic character of these intellectual constructs, be it Ibn Sina's philosophy or Ibn Arabi's mysticism, that invited the severe attack by the representatives of Islamic orthodoxy. Despite the inner weakness and inadequacy of the orthodox system itself, particularly of the Ash'arite theology, which in its cardinal tenets of the inefficacy of the human will and purposelessness of the divine law was in conflict with the Quran, it was nevertheless not difficult for an Al-Ghazali or Ibn Taymiyyah and several others to locate the basic discrepancy between Ibn Sina's metaphysics or Ibn Arabi's theosophy and the Islamic teaching. The upshot of this is that Islamic intellectualism has remained truncated. This piecemeal, ad hoc, and often quite extrinsic treatment of the Quran has not ceased in modern times. Indeed, in some respects, it has worsened. The pressures exerted by modern ideas and forces of social change, together with the colonial interregnum in Muslim lands, has brought about a situation in which the adoption of certain key modern Western ideas and institutions is resolutely defended by some Muslims and often justified through the Quran. The wholesale rejection of modernity is vehemently advocated by others, and the production of apologetic literature that substitutes self-glorification for reform is virtually endless. Against this background, the evolving of some adequate hermeneutical method seems imperative. Such a method, in my view, involves certain factors and excludes certain others, It is exclusively concerned with the cognitive aspect of the revelation and not with its aesthetic appreciative or power appreciative aspects. All revelation is a work of art and inspires a sense of the beautiful and a sense of awesome majesty. In Sufi terminology, Jamal and Jalal. But above all, it inspires that irreducible attitude of the mind called faith, which is both captivating and demanding. The Quran is preeminently so. But the method of Quranic hermeneutics I am talking about is concerned with an understanding of its message that will enable those who have faith in it and want to live by its guidance in both their individual and collective lives to do so coherently and meaningfully. In this purely cognitive effort, both Muslims and, in certain areas, non-Muslims can share, provided the latter have the necessary sympathy and sincerity. But faith, which provides the motivation necessary to live by it, is, of course, characteristic only of those who are genuine Muslims. I do not deny that faith may be born out of this cognitive effort itself, or that, more patently, faith may and ought to lead to such a cognitive effort, but the point is that pure cognition and emotive faith can be practically separated. When I talk about pure cognition, this does not mean cognition of historical facts to the exclusion of values. On the contrary, my central preoccupation is precisely with values, their meaning, and their interpretation. But a cognition of historical values is also possible, with an adequate understanding, but without necessarily involving faith. Although, of course, faith may be generated through an understanding of values, if that faith is not simply dogmatic. However, my use of the term historical values must also be made clear. All values that are properly moral, and it is these with which we shall be concerned, have also an extra-historical, transcendental being, and their location at a point in history does not exhaust their practical impact, or, one might even say, their meaning. This category of values is different from certain other categories, for example, purely economic values. A certain economic value, represented by a certain society at a certain past time, exhausts its life within that socioeconomic context, and its meaning does not overflow that context, but not so with a moral value. The process of interpretation proposed here consists of a double movement, from the present situation to Quranic times, then back to the present. The Quran is the divine response, through the Prophet's mind, to the moral social situation of the Prophet's Arabia, particularly to the problems of the commercial Meccan society of his day. The Quran, quite early, speaks of a burden that was breaking your back, which was relieved by the revelation. Surah 94, Ayat 1 through 3. The revelation, of course, entailed a further burdensome call. Surah 73, Ayah 5. The early surahs of the Quran make it abundantly clear that the acute problems in that society were polytheism, idol worship, exploitation of the poor, malpractices in trade, and general irresponsibility toward society, which there is good reason to believe the Quran perceived as interconnected. The Quran put forward the idea of a unique God to whom all humans are responsible, and the goal of eradication of gross socioeconomic inequity. Quranic theology and moral and legal teachings then gradually unfolded themselves in the political arena. The Meccans' rejection of Muhammad's message, the protracted debates that followed, and later, in the Medinan phase of his life, the controversy waged against Jews and to some extent against Christians formed the backdrop against which the Quran was revealed. We see, then, that the Quran and the genesis of the Islamic community occurred in the light of history and against a social historical background. The Quran is a response to that situation, and for the most part, it consists of moral, religious, and social pronouncements that respond to specific problems confronted in concrete historical situations. Sometimes, the Quran simply gives an answer to a question or a problem, but usually, these answers are stated in terms of an explicit or semi-explicit ratio legis, while there are also certain general laws enunciated from time to time. But, even where simple answers are given, it is possible to understand their reasons and hence deduce general laws by studying the background materials, which, for the most part, have been fairly intelligibly presented by the commentators. The first of the two movements mentioned above, then, consists of two steps. First, one must understand the import or meaning of a given statement by studying the historical situation or problem to which it was the answer. Of course, before coming to the study of specific texts in the light of specific situations, a general study of the macro situation in terms of society, religion, customs, and institutions, indeed of life as a whole in Arabia on the eve of Islam, and particularly in and around Mecca, not excluding the Perso-Byzantine Wars, will have to be made. The first step of the first movement, then, consists of understanding the meaning of the Quran as a whole, as well as in terms of the specific tenets that constitute responses to specific situations. The second step is to generalize those specific answers and enunciate them as statements of general moral social objectives that can be distilled from specific texts in light of the socio-historical background and the often stated rationes legis. Indeed, the first step, the understanding of the meaning of the specific text, itself implies the second step and will lead to it. Throughout this process, due regard must be paid to the tenor of the teaching of the Quran as a whole, so that each given meaning understood, each law enunciated, and each objective formulated will cohere with the rest. The Quran as a whole does inculcate a definite attitude toward life and does have a concrete Weltanschauung. It also claims that its teaching has no inner contradiction, but coheres as a whole. I shall presently remark upon the nature and the feasibility of this task of understanding. I should note here, however, that, besides language, grammar, style, etc., a study of the views of Muslims, most particularly those of the earliest generations, will be helpful. But these views must occupy a secondary place to the objective materials outlined above, since historical interpretations of the Quran, although they will be of help, are also to be judged by the understanding gained from the Quran itself. There are several reasons for this. First, little attempt has ever been made to understand the Quran as a unity. Further, with the passage of time and the rise, growth, and hardening of different points of view and preconceived notions, subjective interpretations have multiplied. The historical tradition will therefore be more an object of judgment for the new understanding than an aid to it, although this historical traditional product can undoubtedly yield insights. Whereas the first movement has been from the specifics of the Quran to the eliciting and systematizing of its general principles, values, and long-range objectives, the second is to be from this general view to the specific view that is to be formulated and realized now. That is, the general has to be embodied in the present, concrete socio-historical context. This, once again, requires the careful study of the present situation and the analysis of its various component elements so we can assess the current situation and change the present to whatever extent necessary, and so we can determine priorities afresh in order to implement the Quranic values afresh. To the extent that we achieve both moments of this double movement successfully, the Quran's imperatives will become alive and effective once again. While the first task is primarily the work of the historian, in the performance of the second, the instrumentality of the social scientist is obviously indispensable. But the actual effective orientation and ethical engineering are the work of the ethicist. This second moment will also act as a corrective of the results of the first, that is, of understanding and interpretation. For if the results of understanding fail in application now, then either there has been a failure to assess the present situation correctly, or a failure in understanding the Quran. For it is not possible that something that could be and actually was realized in the specific texture of the past cannot, allowing for the difference in the specifics of the present situation, be realized in the present context, where allowing for the difference in the specifics of the present situation includes both changing the rules of the past in conformity with the altered situation of the present, provided this changing does not violate the general principles and values derived from the past, and changing the present situation, where necessary, so it is brought into conformity with these general principles and values. Both tasks imply intellectual jihad, the second implying also a moral jihad, or endeavor, in addition to the intellectual. The intellectual endeavor, or jihad, including the intellectual elements of both the moments, past and present, is technically called ijtihad, which means the effort to understand the meaning of a relevant text or precedent in the past, containing a rule, and to alter that rule by extending or restricting or otherwise modifying it in such a manner that a new situation can be subsumed under it by a new solution. This definition itself implies that a text or precedent can be generalized as a principle, and that the principle can then be formulated as a new rule. This implies that the meaning of a past text or precedent, the present situation, and the intervening tradition can be sufficiently objectively known, and that the tradition can be fairly objectively brought under the judgment of the normative meaning of the past, under whose impact the tradition arose. It follows from this that tradition can be studied with adequate historical objectivity and separated not only from the present, but also from the normative factors that are supposed to have generated it. In modern hermeneutical theory, the objectivity school has insisted that one must, first of all, ascertain the meaning intended by the mind that authored the object of study. According to E. Betti, a contemporary representative of this school, the process of understanding is a reversal of the original creative process. The forms that we try to understand and interpret now are to be led back to the creative mind whose original contents they were, not as isolated items, but as a coherent whole, and made to live again in the mind of the understanding subject. It should be pointed out, however, that this unity of forms cannot be attributed simply to the mind. One must also consider the situation to which it is a response. This, of course, admits of varying degrees, but certainly, in the case of the Quran, the objective situation is a sine qua non for understanding, particularly since, in view of its absolute normativity for Muslims, it is literally God's response through Muhammad's mind. This latter factor has been radically underplayed by the Islamic orthodoxy. To a historic situation, a factor likewise drastically restricted by the Islamic orthodoxy in a real understanding of the Quran. The view of the objectivity school has been criticized by Hans Georg Gadamer in the work cited above as psychologism and as subjective. While it is true that representatives of this school often speak as though the being of ideas in the author's mind is crucial to understanding them, consult Betti's view described above, where he seeks to trace back ideas to the original mind in order to understand them as a true unity, whereas I have contended that the invisible context of ideas is not just mental, but environmental as well. They surely do not conceive of ideas only as mental events, for while their occurrence is in a mind, their intentio, or meaning, is referred outside the mind. Against this view, Gadamer maintains his phenomenological doctrine according to which all experience of understanding presupposes a preconditioning of the experiencing subject, and, therefore, without due acknowledgement of this fact of being predetermined, which is the essence of Gadamer's entire hermeneutical theory, any attempt to understand anything is doomed to unscientific vitiation. What so predetermines me as an understanding subject is what Gadamer calls the effective history, That is, not only the historical influence of the object of investigation, but the totality of other influences that make up the very texture of my being. Thus, there is no question of any objective understanding of anything at all. Even when we become aware of this predetermination, that is, develop an effective historical consciousness, as distinguished from ordinary historical consciousness, the former is so limited that it cannot overcome this preconditioning. It is, of course, clear that this doctrine is radically opposed to what I have contended above by way of the hermeneutics of the Quran. If Gadamer's thesis is correct, then the double movement theory I have put forward has no meaning at all. No wonder a thinker like Betti rejects Gadamer's view as hopelessly subjective. Obviously, the burden of my argument, writes Gadamer, is that this quality of being determined by effective history still dominates the modern historical and scientific consciousness, and that beyond any possible knowledge of this domination. The effective historical consciousness is so radically finite that our whole being, achieved in the totality of our destiny, inevitably transcends its knowledge of itself. Again, in fact, history does not belong to us, but we belong to it. Long before we understand ourselves through the process of self-examination, we understand ourselves in a self-evident way in the family, society, and state in which we live. The self-awareness of the individual is only a flickering in the closed circuits of historical life. The task of philosophical hermeneutics is to clarify precisely this predetermination. Hence, from the viewpoint of philosophical hermeneutics, the contrast between historical and dogmatic method has no absolute validity. The principle of effective history stated blandly, of course, will not work. It is obvious that there have been changes in human traditions, sometimes radical. In Christianity, the effective history of a 5th century Augustine, a 13th century Aquinas, and a 16th century Luther could not have been quite the same. But what is even more important than that is that the conscious thought product of those men brought vast and vital changes into the subsequent effective history. So is the case with a 10th century Al-Ash'ari, an 11th century Al-Ghazali, and a 14th century Ibn Taymiyyah. Islamic tradition was never the same again after the conscious activity of each and all of them. Every critique or modification of a tradition involves a consciousness of what is being criticized or rejected, and hence, to that extent, self-awareness. In view of the revolutionary changes wrought by some men in their traditions, it is therefore not proper to say that the self-awareness of the individual is only a flickering in the closed circuits of historical life. It is also untenable to say that their responses were predetermined, and primarily by their effective histories. What seems reasonable to hold is that all conscious responses to the past involve two moments that must be distinguished. One is the objective ascertaining of the past, which Gadamer does not allow, which is possible in principle, provided requisite evidence is available. The other is the response itself, which necessarily involves values and which is determined, not predetermined, by my present situation, of which effective history is a part, but of which my conscious effort and self-aware activity also constitute an important part. For Gadamer, these two moments are utterly inseparable and indistinguishable. By his statement that there is no absolute contrast between the historical and the dogmatic methods, Professor Gadamer wants to say that both are limited by the effective historical element, but that both are able to question tradition, there being only a difference of degree between the two. One might point out that questioning in the historical method is the questioning of historical facts, since, by definition and as an ideal, it does not concern itself with values, whereas questioning in the dogmatic method is primarily the questioning of traditional values. First of all, it is highly doubtful if even in the dogmatic questioning process some historical consciousness is not involved, since the fact that the tradition is the tradition of the past presupposes some historical distance. But, more important, one wonders if the term dogmatic is proper in this context, since what Gadamer has characterized as the dogmatic, that is, non-historical or prehistorical, method of questioning tradition, emerges on closer examination as a rational method of questioning. When Augustine or Luther questioned their traditions, their questioning was within the dogmatic field, but surely their method of questioning was rational. That is, they believed that certain parts of their tradition were incompatible with and contradictory to other more basic parts of that tradition. Here, then, in place of the historical distance or space, a rational space mediates between the past and the present, although, as I have said, a historical consciousness is not lacking completely, but perhaps is present as a secondary phenomenon. Thus, if one asks, what is the predetermining effective history of a certain tradition? There is no straightforward answer, since it depends on an answer to the further question, for whom? In the case of a consciousness that has been able to work deliberate change in that tradition, the answer would be the tradition minus the change that that particular consciousness has wrought. This means that the process of questioning and changing a tradition, in the interests of preserving or restoring its normative quality in the case of its normative elements, can continue indefinitely, and that there is no fixed or privileged point at which the predetermining effective history is immune from such questioning, and then being consciously confirmed or consciously changed. This is what is required for an adequate hermeneutical method of the Quran, as I have outlined it herein. Chapter 1. The Heritage. The Quran and the Prophet. When one reviews the performance of Muhammad as a religious leader and studies the Quran closely as the document of his revelatory experiences, one cannot fail to perceive that an inner unity and an unmistakable sense of direction, despite the multitude of different historical situations faced and exigencies met, are displayed in the Prophet's activity and the Quranic guidance. I am, of course, talking not of the actual effect this teaching had upon Muhammad's early or late followers, the treatment of which will follow this section, but of the nature and the quality of this teaching, viewed in its setting, with reference to its historical context on the one hand, and the personality of the Prophet on the other. In this section, I will be concerned with this teaching in its major features and this performance in its bold outlines, rather than with the minutiae of details, in order to bring out their originality and their potentialities. It seems certain that, because of their mutual involvement and interdependence, the doctrines of the one Creator-Sustainer God, of the necessity of socio-economic justice, and of the Last Judgment, were elements of the original religious experience of Muhammad. As this experience unfolds under the general refusal of the Meccans to accept his teaching, the idea of a judgment in history upon nations in accordance with the quality of their collective behavior originates and gains steady strength in the middle and some years of the last Meccan periods. In fact, it almost overshadows that of the Last Judgment until Medina, where, owing to the new opportunities of the task of constructing an ethically based socio-political order, accounts of divine judgment upon earlier nations and their fates are no longer called for. Yet the idea of a universal judgment continues. Although both God consciousness and the conviction of the last day are powerful and persistent themes in the Quran, there is no doubt that belief in God and human accountability play a strictly functional role there. The central concern of the Quran is the conduct of man. Just as in Kantian terms, no ideal knowledge is possible without the regulative ideas of reason, like first cause, so in Quranic terms, no real morality is possible without the regulative ideas of God and the Last Judgment. Further, Their very moral function requires that they exist for religio-moral experience and cannot be mere intellectual postulates to be believed in. God is the transcendent anchoring point of attributes such as life, creativity, power, mercy, and justice, including retribution, and of moral values to which a human society must be subject if it is to survive and prosper, a ceaseless struggle for the cause of the good. This constant struggle is the keynote of man's normative existence and constitutes the service, ibadah, to God, with which the Quran squarely and inexorably charges him. But the substantive or constitutive, as Kantian phraseology would have it, teaching of the Prophet and the Quran is undoubtedly for action in this world, since it provides guidance for man concerning his behavior on earth in relation to other men. God exists in the mind of the believer to regulate his behavior if he is religio-morally experienced, but that which is to be regulated is the essence of the matter. The bane of later medieval Islam, as we shall presently see, was that what was regulative, namely God, was made the exclusive object of experience, and thus, instead of men's seeking values from this experience, the experience became the end in itself. Whether or not this experience had any other content, eminent Sufis themselves, like Al-Ghazali and Al-Sirhindi, thought it had none, and this view seems to me both intelligible and correct. It was mostly either neutral to social morality or even negatively related to it. The intellectual efforts of Christian theologians to unravel the nature of God as love and the mysteries of the Trinity were empty formalism compared with the Sufi experience of God, for the latter at least had a positive and enriching influence on personality building, though mostly individual and asocial. Nevertheless, the Christian theology had the beneficial effect of sharpening the mind, and therefore, when that mind later was applied to the natural world, it produced amazing results in the scientific field. But the bane of modernity, in the form of secularism, is far worse than that of either medieval Islamic Sufism or medieval Christian theology, since secularism destroys the sanctity and universality, transcendence, of all moral values, a phenomenon whose effects have just begun to make themselves felt most palpably in Western societies. Secularism is necessarily atheistic. So far as the establishment of an ethically based social order is concerned, and this is the greatest desideratum of mankind today, the effects of medieval Islamic Sufism, of the Christian obsession with theology, or of modern secularism differ little. How different and how morally invigorating are the concerns of the Quran, for the Prophet, judging from both the Quran and his Sunnah, that is, his exemplary conduct, was God intoxicated, and the Quran itself certainly appears to be theocentric. But this deep God consciousness is creatively and organically related to the founding of an ethical socio-political order in the world, since, in the view of the Quran, those who forget God eventually forget themselves. Surah 59, Ayah 19. And their individual and corporate personalities disintegrate. It is this God consciousness that sent Muhammad out of the cave of Hira, where he was wont to contemplate, into the world, never to return to that cave or the contemplative life again. What issued from his experience in the cave was not merely the demolishing of a plurality of gods, but a sustained and determined effort to achieve socio-economic justice. He aimed at constituting a community for goodness and justice in the world, what I have called an ethically based socio-political order under God, that is, according to the principle that moral values cannot be made and unmade by man at his own whim or convenience and should not be misused or abused for the sake of expediency. Muhammad tried to strengthen and enfranchise the weaker segments of society, as well as to divest the privileged of their prerogatives in the religious field, the clergy, in the political field, autocratic or oligarchic rule, and in the socio-economic field, undue economic or sex power. Mr. Maxime Rodinson has aptly characterized Muhammad as a combination of Charlemagne, who spread Christianity among the Saxon tribes of Germans, primarily so as to establish and consolidate an empire, and Jesus, whose kingdom was not of this world. When one studies the social aspect of Muhammad's reform, two features appear striking. First, before introducing a major measure of social change, the ground was well prepared. Of course, in the sector of public legislation, the Prophet did not have the power to act while he was in Mecca. It was only in Medina, where he had political and administrative authority, that he could legislate. Thus, although Quranic warnings against usury were issued in Mecca, usury was not legally banned until the Prophet had been in Medina for some time. Similarly, emphatic statements concerning amelioration of the condition of the poor were made from the beginning of Islam. Indeed, this, coupled with the unity of God, was the motive force for the genesis of the Islamic movement. But laws in this field, including the law of the zakat tax, were not promulgated until well after the Prophet had settled in Medina, although the measure of brotherhood, muahat, between the local population, Ansar, and the Meccan immigrants, muhajirun, was taken soon after his arrival in Medina. Such instances militate against the liberal use of the principle of graduation in Quranic legislation, so much exploited by later Muslim jurists and many present-day reformers. Nevertheless, it is beyond doubt that he made no precipitate decisions on important issues of public policy, but awaited the coming down of revelation. The Prophet was naturally a shy and reticent person, and did not intrude into people's affairs so long as they ran smoothly. The portrayal of him by later juristic literature as ceaselessly coming forth with decision upon decision, more often than not contradictory, on real or hypothetical questions, is decidedly false. It goes without saying that he never gave decisions on purely hypothetical issues or on issues that were never brought to his notice. On the other hand, despite Muhammad's reticence, an equally determined will unfailingly comes through, a will that spurns compromises on fundamental issues. One does not need to remind oneself that a man with this mixture of opposing mental traits and conscious of a heavy mission, as the Quran says, must be engaged in a constant inner dialectic, the ideal moral state for man to be in, according to the Quran. The verses in Surah 53, where the Prophet had reportedly made concessions to the goddesses of the Meccan pagans that were subsequently abrogated, is, along with other Quranic evidence, a direct proof of this phenomenon. The second side of the Prophet, his determination, finally won over his other side. If there were an artist in the world who could portray pure moral states, the Prophet's picture would emerge as most interesting, attractive, and significant. The second all-important feature of the legislation of the Quran is that it, like the decisions of the Prophet, always had a background or a historical context, which the Muslim commentators of the Quran call occasions of revelation. But the literature on the occasions of revelation is often highly contradictory and chaotic. The basic reason for this state of affairs seems to be that, although most Quranic commentators were aware of the importance of these situational contexts, either because of their historical significance or for their aid in understanding the point of certain injunctions, they never realized their full import, particularly from the second point of view. Instead, they enunciated the principle that, although an injunction might have been occasioned by a certain situation, it is nevertheless universal in its general application. This principle is sound enough, provided it means by an injunction the value underlying that injunction and not merely its literal wording. But the value can be yielded only by understanding well not only the language, but above all the situational context of a given injunction. This, however, was generally not done, since, as I have just said, the real significance of the occasions of revelation was not realized. From the chaos reigning in the field, although there is some historical information on many important points as well, one can guess that, since these developments had occurred during their own lifetime, the Prophet's immediate followers, the companions, did not care to record them or get them recorded, while later generations, although possessing a certain amount of reliable information, were left to guess at what these occasions might have been. Also, in their social and collective behavior, Arabs, like all tribally organized societies, were highly custom-bound, and a set pattern of behavior, called sunnah, acquired sanctity for them, hence the intense and protracted opposition to Muhammad, who broke this set pattern, often at its most sensitive points. Once an absolutely normative revealed document like the Quran became established, however, given the habit of adherence to set patterns, the Arabs were naturally loath to deviate from its literal meaning. This largely explains the astounding degree of integrity of the Quranic text over many centuries. There is no doubt that early scholars of Islam and leaders of the community exercised a good deal of freedom and ingenuity in interpreting the Quran, including the principles of ijtihad, personal reasoning, and qiyas, analogical reasoning from a certain text of the Quran and arguing on its basis to solve a new case or problem that has certain essential resemblances to the former. There was, however, no well-argued-out system of rules for these procedures, and early legal schools sometimes went too far in using this freedom. For this reason, in the late 8th century CE, al-Shafi'i successfully fought for the general acceptance of traditions from the Prophet as a basis for interpretation instead of ijtihad or qiyas. Yet the real solution lay only in understanding the Quranic injunctions strictly in their context and background, and trying to extrapolate the principles or values that lay behind the injunctions of the Quran and the prophetic Sunnah. But this line was never developed systematically, at least by Muslim jurists. In most cases, however, it is not difficult to see the real point of a verse or the basic import of a given injunction. The Quran, for the most part, explicitly states why an order is being given or a statement or comment is being made, even though it rarely refers to a specific case by name. Thus, in the case of riba, usury, the actual case of those tribes who, burdened by incurable riba debts, were threatening to cause trouble, is not mentioned at all. Yet the institution of riba is denounced in the strongest possible terms as an abominable form of exploitation, and a threat of war from God and His Messenger is issued against those who do not desist from it. Even when the reason for a certain command is not explicitly stated, it is not difficult to guess it. If one peruses the inheritance verses, for example, it becomes clear that the Quran is essentially extending the right of inheritance to women who did not possess that right in pre-Islamic Arab law, and is therefore concerned with establishing those categories of relations who have a right to inheritance. But, second, it is also pointing out the usefulness of these potential inheritors to the propositus on the basis of kinship by saying, "You do not know whether your fathers are more beneficial to you or your sons." Surah 4, Ayah 11. Therefore, even though the Quran seldom refers to actual events and situations and almost never mentions names, it would be inaccurate to characterize it as an esoteric document, for it is eminently possible to accurately determine the rationales behind its statements, comments, and injunctions. The basic élan of the Quran, the stress on socio-economic justice and essential human egalitarianism, is quite clear from its very early passages. Now all that follows by way of Quranic legislation in the field of private and public life, even the five pillars of Islam that are held to be religion par excellence, has social justice and the building of an egalitarian community as its end. To insist on a literal implementation of the rules of the Quran shutting one's eyes to the social change that has occurred and that is so palpably occurring before our eyes is tantamount to deliberately defeating its moral, social purposes and objectives. It is just as though, in view of the Quranic emphasis on freeing slaves, one were to insist on preserving the institution of slavery so that one could earn merit in the sight of God by freeing slaves. Surely, the whole tenor of the teaching of the Quran is that there should be no slavery at all. The sort of reasoning that would retain slavery is, of course, seldom employed by any intelligent and morally sensitive Muslim. But there is an argument used by the vast majority of Muslims, and indeed primarily by the majority of Muslim religious leaders, that is very similar in nature. It is that, since it is a pillar of Islam to pay zakat levy, a tax the Quran had imposed primarily, but by no means exclusively, on the rich for the welfare of the poor, some people must remain poor in order for the rich to earn merit in the sight of God. There is, of course, no society on earth in which there are no needy people, and in Islam the state, through its zakat system, has to fulfill their needs. But an argument like this one seeks to give a decisive blow to the very orientation of the Quran and provides the best kind of prop for the communist slogan that religion is the opiate of the masses. Or, again, to say that no matter how much women may develop intellectually, their evidence must, on principle, carry less value than that of a man, is an outrageous affront to the Quran's purposes of social evolution, and so on. Just as we can see the broad, humane principles of justice, mutual help, and mercy worked into the fabric of the Quranic legislation, so, conversely, does the movement of the mind from the concrete legislation of the Quran back to the general principles end up on the same broad principles that constituted its primary élan. Muslims, and particularly modernist Muslims, have often contended that the Quran gives us the principles, while the Sunnah, or our reasoning, embodies these fundamentals in concrete solutions. This is considerably less than a half-truth and is dangerously misleading. If we look at the Quran, it does not, in fact, give many general principles. For the most part, it gives solutions to and rulings upon specific and concrete historical issues, but, as I have said, it provides, either explicitly or implicitly, the rationales behind these solutions and rulings, from which one can deduce general principles. In fact, this is the only sure way to obtain the real truth about the Quranic teaching. One must generalize on the basis of Quranic treatment of actual cases, taking into due consideration the socio-historical situation then obtaining, since, although one can find some general statements or principles there, these, for the most part, are embedded in concrete treatments of actual issues, whence they must be disengaged. The net conclusion to be drawn from these considerations is the following. In building any genuine and viable Islamic set of laws and institutions, there has to be a twofold movement. First, one must move from the concrete case treatments of the Quran, taking the necessary and relevant social conditions of that time into account, to the general principles upon which the entire teaching converges. Second, from this general level, there must be a movement back to specific legislation, taking into account the necessary and relevant social conditions now obtaining. The contention that certainty belongs not to the meanings of particular verses of the Quran and their content, by certainty I mean not their revealed character, for undoubtedly the Quran is revealed in its entirety, but the certainty of our understanding of their true meaning and import, but to the Quran as a whole, that is, as a set of coherent principles or values where the total teaching will converge, might appear shocking to many Muslims who have been for centuries habituated to think of the laws of the Quran in a discrete, atomistic, and totally unintegrated manner, even though the Quran loudly proclaims that it is a highly integrated and cohesive body of teaching. The following statement of the famous Maliki jurist al-Shatibi, died 1388, should convince them not only of its reasonableness, but of its absolute necessity. After stating that eternal validity belongs only to the general principles, usul kulliya, and not to the particulars of the Quran, al-Shatibi goes on. This being so, that is, that pure reason divorced from the Sharia principles is unable to yield religio-moral values, reliance must be placed primarily on Sharia proofs in deducing law. But according to their common use, these latter either have no certainty at all or very little. I mean when Sharia proofs are taken one by one. This is because if these proofs are in the category of hadiths coming from single or isolated chains of transmission, it is obvious that they yield no certainty. But if these hadiths are traceable to an overwhelming number of chains of transmission, mutawattir, certainty with regard to them, that is, their meaning, depends upon premises all or most of which are only conjectural. Now that which depends upon what is uncertain is inevitably itself uncertain as well. For a determination of their meaning depends upon the correct transmission of linguistic usage, grammatical opinions, etc. Thus, taking all these factors into consideration, the possibility of establishing with certainty the meaning of these hadiths is nil. Some jurists have taken refuge in the view that although these Sharia proofs are in themselves uncertain, when they are supported by indirect evidence or concomitants, qara'in, they can yield assurance, but this occurs rarely or not at all. The proofs considered reliable here are only those inducted from a number of conjectural proofs which converge upon an idea in such a manner that they can yield certainty, for a totality of proofs possesses a strength which separate and disparate proofs do not possess. This is the reason why an overwhelming tradition possesses certainty, and this, that is, the case under discussion here, is such a case. When, through inducting from a whole range of conjectural proofs of a certain point, a coherent totality emerges that can yield sure knowledge, that constitutes the desired proof. It is in this way that the obligatoriness of the five principles, like prayer, zakat, etc., has been absolutely established. Otherwise, if someone were to argue for the obligatoriness of prayer basing himself only on God's repeated statements in the Quran, Surah 2, Ayah 43, 83, and 110, Surah 4, Ayah 77, Surah 6, Ayah 72, etc., and establish prayers, this kind of proof, taken by itself, would be open to several objections. But then, this proof is supported all round by other indirect evidence and well-ordered rules whereby the duty of prayer is rendered absolutely obligatory in religion, such that a person who doubts it is like one who doubts the very basis of religion. When you consider why consensus is an irrefutable proof, or a report from a single chain of transmission, or reasoning by analogy, can become an irrefutable proof, it is all reducible to this method. For in all these cases, that is, a consensus, an isolated report, or an analogy, proofs are adduced from places that are innumerable, and also they come from different kinds of sources, which cannot be reduced to a single type. And yet, they all converge upon one idea, which is the object of all probative reasoning. Thus, when various proofs concerning a certain matter abound and are mutually corroborative, through their total effect they produce certainty. This is the case with sources of proofs used in this book. They are the sources whence principles are derived. But the earlier jurists often left this fact unmentioned and did not explicitly state it, so that some later jurists ignored it altogether. Consequently, arguing on the basis of individual verses of the Quran and individual hadiths became difficult, since such a jurist did not argue on the basis of their cumulative force. Thus, the opponent was able to attack each individual textual proof separately and weakened its probative value in accordance with rules governing principles that are supposed to guide certainty. Yet, if these texts are taken in this way, that is, in their totality and cumulative effect, there is no difficulty. But if the Sharia proofs for general principles as well as particulars are taken as such an opponent takes them, we should be left without any certainty at all with regard to any Sharia rule whatever, unless we bring in reason as a partner. Reason, however, can play its role only after the Sharia bases are there. It is necessary, therefore, to follow this convergence principle in order to establish the fundamental proofs. Development of Islamic Disciplines. If I am correct in the criterion of true Islamicity I have laid down in the foregoing and have corroborated with a lengthy quotation from an eminent Muslim jurist, namely that a doctrine or an institution is genuinely Islamic to the extent that it flows from the total teaching of the Quran and the Sunnah, and hence successfully applies to an appropriate situation or satisfies a requirement, then it will not be Islamic to the extent that it does not flow from the teaching of the Quran and the Sunnah as a whole, and hence will not solve a given problem or apply to a given situation Islamically. There are two ways such a body of teaching may be said to be applied as a whole to a given situation, be it social, political, or economic. First, someone may have lived through that teaching and thus have wholly internalized or ingested it so that, when a given situation presented itself, he judged the situation in the light of what he had ingested. The second method, intellectual in character in contradistinction to the first method, which may be called experiential, involves an analysis of that teaching in both historical and systematic terms, that is, it views the unfolding of the Quran and the Sunnah historically, so as to understand their meaning, and then systematically arranges values in order of priority and posteriority, subordinating the more particular to the more general and ultimate, and thus obtains an answer from this system for a given problem or a given situation. After the death of the Prophet, and particularly when soon thereafter Muslims expanded outside the Arabian Peninsula and faced new administrative, juridical, and fiscal situations, their way of dealing with these situations was more like the first than the second method, although the second, the intellectually deliberative, was not totally lacking. This was only natural, for during the lifetime of the Prophet, although the more thinking minds among his companions must have reflected on certain matters, he was there to give the necessary decisions. Hence, at his death, the Muslims inherited the Quran and the Prophet's example, but no detailed, intellectually worked-out system of thought. When new questions were referred to them, for example in Iraq or Egypt, they gave answers that, although taking into account local customs and practices, were based primarily upon the general teaching of the Quran that they had actually lived through and by which their being had been permeated, rather than, in general, appealing to individual verses of the Quran or texts of the Sunnah, unless such verses had a clear-cut and direct bearing on the issue. Of course, even among the companions of the Prophet, not everyone was of the same caliber or of the same depth of intimacy with the inner thinking of the Quran and of the Prophet. The nucleus of the Prophet's followers consisted of relatively few people, and not every companion was an Umar or an Ali or an Ibn Mas'ud. It was for this reason, then, because the men of the first generation of Islam gave judgments in the light of their experience of the Quranic teaching as a whole, that they did not quote individual verses unless these had a direct bearing on the problem under question. It was, in fact, more to the point on their part to quote a concrete precedent from the Prophet's life, if one was available. Otherwise, they relied on the overall understanding of the purposes of the Quran. A striking illustration is provided by Umar's refusal after the conquest of Iraq to divide that land among the Muslim conquering soldiers as booty, in accordance with the Prophet's general practice within Arabia. Umar's intuition was that the Prophet's practice concerning tribal territories was no longer practicable now that whole countries were being conquered. Under insistent pressure from the opposition, Omar finally appealed to the Quran, Surah 59, Ayat 10, to buttress the stand he had taken without quoting any specific verse of the Quran, but in the interest of the general Quranic demands for social justice and fair play. It was this kind of situation that led Jay Schacht to make the astonishing statement in his Origins of Muhammadan Jurisprudence that in the early decision-making process in Islam, the Quran was invariably introduced at a secondary stage. If this statement means, as it apparently does, that Muslims ignored the Quran in the first instance, it is unintelligible and absurd. But if it means that early Muslims acted first upon their experience of the totality of the Quranic teaching and introduced the citation of particular verses only at a secondary stage, then this statement describes a phenomenon that is both natural and intelligible. The most crucial stage in the development of the religious sciences is reached during the next two generations, the successors and successors to the successors. These two generations had not, of course, been witnesses to the unfolding of the Quran and the Prophet's mission. Nevertheless, there were among